Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the pod, and today I talked with Patricia Schiaffini-Vadani and Michael Monhart about Enticement, a volume of translated short stories by Tibetan author Pema Tseten. Pema Tseten is from Chika, a region of what Tibetans call Amdo, that is located in contemporary Qinghai province of the People's Republic of China. He is Tibet's most famous filmmaker and has won awards internationally for his visual storytelling. Less well known, however, is that he is also a prolific author and translator. Unlike many of his peers, Pema Tseten writes in both Chinese and Tibetan, and this volume includes works translated from both. Enticement is sure to be an important volume better introducing this incredible author's work to an English-speaking audience in an accessible and engaging manner. My conversation with the translators ranged from a discussion of the process of translating these stories to the contents of the stories themselves. It was a fantastic conversation that's given me personally plenty to think about. I hope you'll enjoy it too.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm joined by Patricia Schiaffini-Vadani and Michael Monhart, the translators and editors of a new volume called that translates the works of Pema Tseten called Enticement, Stories of Tibet, and published from State University of New York Press. Patricia is one of the pioneers of the study of Sinophone Tibetan literature, a professor at Texas State University, and also the president and founder of Tibetan Arts and Literature Initiative, an NGO devoted to training Tibetan teachers and promoting Tibetan language education and literacy in China. Michael, on the other hand, is a Jungian psychologist in private practice in New York and a longtime scholar of Tibetan studies, who has done fieldwork in Tibetan monasteries in Nepal and published and lectured widely on Tibetan ritual music. Patty and Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. So to start off, I was wondering if you guys could tell us a little bit about yourselves.
Michael, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, I started my studies in Tibetan many years ago, when I first did a graduate program at the University of Washington in ethnomusicology. And the music that attracted me most and actually got me into the field of ethnomusicology was Tibetan ritual music and my puzzlement about what was behind this music, how was it put together. And so I started studying Tibetan at the University of Washington, which back in the 1980s had a great program. After working for a while, I returned in, the early 2000s and did another master's at Columbia in East Asian languages and specifically Tibetan. Did some field work and did some language study in Nepal and in India. I met Pema probably 6-7 years ago when the Lhotse Foundation brought him to New York City. to just improve his English skills in the hopes of helping his professional career along. I'd had some experience teaching English as a second language, and especially to Tibetans. So I volunteered to teach him English, not really even knowing who he was. And so as we progressed along, he said, "Oh, I make movies, and here's a movie." And then he said, "Oh, I also write short stories. Here's a short story." And that's how I got to know him and got to start translating his stories.
In my case, my studies were in Chinese language and literature, and I studied in China for 4 years at the University of Beijing University. And while I was studying there, a classmate of mine brought to my attention short stories written by Sino-Tibetan authors that resemble the style of magical realism. So I started studying those works and translating them, and that's what led me to discover more about modern Tibetan literature. And then I came to the U.S. for my master's and my PhD degrees, and I decided to do my PhD dissertation on magical realism in the works of Trasitava and other writers that Tibetan writers that were writing in Chinese. And I just cannot recall when was the first time I met Pema many years ago, but I also met him when he came at that time that he spent several months in the U.S. And that at that time is when we started talking about the possibility of translating his works. But of course, the issue that you know, the advantage is that Pema writes in both languages, Chinese and Tibetan, but it was a disadvantage for me that I wasn't, I had studied some Tibetan, but I wasn't fluent enough in Tibetan to be able to translate his works written in Tibetan. So that's how we ended up collaborating with Michael on that. And on the side of me being a professor of Chinese language and teaching some courses on modern Tibet as well, I have my nonprofit work with the Tibetan Arts and Literature Initiative, which basically is a way for me to connect with writers that are interested in writing for children and Tibetan illustrators as well, and try to encourage them or fund their books for children that we publish. And recently we also make into short animated movies in order to spread literacy around Tibetan communities. And finally also training Tibetan teachers. So it's a kind of a combination of academic work and just bringing those things to directly benefit Tibetans in China if possible.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. So I guess to start off, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the background of this project in particular. You sort of started in this direction, talking about sort of meeting Pema Tseten, this author, and sort of finding out about his short stories and all that. But you also, I mean, this was a team of four translators across the book. And sometimes working as a team in these collaborations can be a little bit like herding cats. And I was wondering if sort of you would talk about sort of how this project came to be.
Mm-hmm. At the start, it was Michael and I that started working together. But then, for example, you know, we realized that Francois Robin had translated The Doctor, which is such a wonderful story. So I asked her if we could use her story. And what was the point in translating it again if that translation wasn't really very good? So we just asked her to contribute to the volume. And the same with Professor Carl Robertson. He was very interested in the story Tarlo. So I said, "Oh, you love the story so much. Why don't you translate it instead of being myself the one translating it?" So that's how it came to, you know, all of us collaborating. It's been, you know, a wonderful collaboration. It just gave us a little bit of work in terms of trying to come up with a coherent voice through the book. But I think it's been very interesting, kind of reading everybody's drafts and talking about the story.
Brilliant. And I guess before we proceed any further, it perhaps is useful also to sort of introduce Bema Tsetin himself, in case we have any listeners who might be unfamiliar with him. Michael, who is Bema, and why did you guys choose to translate his stories in particular among all the authors out there?
Well, Bema initially, what I think was most well known for his short stories, as Patty said, written in both Tibetan and Chinese. And now I think it certainly has become, if not the most famous, one of the most famous of the Tibetan filmmakers, and is most widely known for his films, which I can highly recommend. Fame has increased a bit. He's been able to access more resources, and his films just continue to develop. But as he has said, he continues to write short stories. My connection to him was purely personal. I got to know him and started to read his stories and found them, I think, just very special and unique in the sense that they, somewhat like his movies, they depict daily life in Tibet. You'd call them secular stories or just depictions of daily life and the issues, primarily non-religious issues that people deal with.
Yes, I think in my case it was kind of the opposite. I started reading his stories and then I got to meet him personally, but he was already a filmmaker and people were already talking about him as a filmmaker, and I thought it was just a pity that people were not, I mean, those who admire him as a filmmaker didn't know about his career as a writer and how wonderful his stories were, and also the variety and depth of, you know, styles and topics that he was dealing with. So that's why I thought it's really worth it to translate this so we can make it available to more people.
Yeah, fantastic. I've always felt that in film, he's absolutely such a fantastic storyteller. And also when I started reading his writing, I had a sort of a similar sort of experience, but I came to it through film first, like you just said, many of the readers will come into Bema Tsetin through film and then into this literature. And it's, I'm really glad that we have this edition. One of the things that you sort of mentioned in the introduction, Michael, you mentioned sort of his portrayals of everydayness, but there were two sort of things that really stood out to me about the storytelling as well, is both the influence of oral tradition and also sort of the way that he ends his stories without sort of a proper conclusion or without sort of, there's sort of this lack of traditional resolution in some ways. And I was wondering, Patricia, if you could talk a little bit about that, about both how he draws on oral traditions, and also maybe a little bit about this sort of the way he concludes these stories and sort of this in his own fashion that also appears in film as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The oral tradition aspect of it is, I think, is very interesting. And it was sometimes a challenge when we were translating. He tends to repeat a lot the language a lot. And that is, at the beginning, I could understand why his characters sometimes in writing, at least, will repeat themselves so much. And then I understood it was an influence of the oral tales, because in the oral tale, the performer needs to kind of recap, right? So it makes a short summary and then repeats again when the audience has changed, maybe it has to repeat again a little bit. So I was starting exploring whether these kind of rhetorical devices could be what were influencing the language of his short stories. So that's my theory. I may be wrong, but that's what I was feeling when I was reading and translating him. And then we had a lot of conversations with him and interviews where we talked about the importance of storytelling and oral tales. And he, you know, told me several times how he used to listen to traditional tales when he was a child, such as, you know, the tales of the golden corpse, right, that were so famous in Tibet. And he was just mesmerized. That was his introduction to literature when he was a child. So I think that background influenced him quite a lot. There is also some, I think that some of the things that you find in his writings, you find in his movies as well. He tends to, he has a tendency of having media inside media, for example, shots of people watching TV. So while we are watching them on the screen as well, and or people listening to the radio while we listen to the dialogue and things like that, that you also can, you know, I think that also can be observed in the way he writes. I don't know if I'm answering your question or you have more specific questions about that.
Oh, no. Well, no, I think that's great. I think I feel that there's both this sort of this formal layer and also this thematic layer in which he's drawing heavily on these oral traditions. And I think that is a really interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. As Patty said, it really, certainly on the Tibetan side, was one of the most significant challenges I faced, because of the structure of Tibetan grammar, but certainly also because of Pema's invocation of the oral tradition. There was quite a lot of repeats, quite literal repeats, which in English can kind of seem stilted or kind of interrupt the flow. But in Tibetan, in the oral tradition, they kind of lend a certain rhythm and cadence to the tale or to the literature. And I think that's actually something that sense of temporality that he conveys in the story is similar to the temporality that a movie holds just by nature.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And your other question was about the unresolved endings, right? So
yes.
I will let Michael start with that one because he had done some thought about it. So
yeah, it's I think it's one of the things I most admire, and thank you, Tim, for pointing it out. It's true in his stories. And it's true in his movies, and I think it goes back to his depiction of real life. In a sense, he resists the temptation to kind of create a certain false narrative and come to a dramatic ending. But it's more like this is a depiction of what someone's life is, and it goes on after the story ends, just like the characters in his movies, their life goes on. So I think there's a real trueness to life there that he conveys by kind of resisting that dramatic ending.
Yeah, there's also the ending is always surprising one way or another. It is surprising because you want it more. You want to know more about what's going on, or it's surprising because it happens all of a sudden, and you're saying, "And now what?" You know. So sometimes I wonder whether it's just not on purpose that he's saying, "You know, I'm not gonna give you the answer of everything, but just a slice of what is happening in the lives of these characters." So I find it very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It was certainly something that stood out to me as well, but it also does seem to be sort of one of the parts of his mastery almost as a storyteller is his ability to sort of know when to just sort of let life continue. Hmm. And it's really interesting. Finally, before moving on to the book itself, Pema Tsetan, as you've both pointed out, is he writes in both Chinese and Tibetan. And some of the stories translated here are actually written in both Chinese and Tibetan, or have both Chinese and Tibetan versions. And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about how you navigated that in your process of creating this book.
Yes, we worked starting from anthologies of his works published in Tibetan and in Chinese, and we talked to him about which short stories we should translate. You know, there were short stories that were our favorites, but we also wanted to hear which short stories he wanted the readers to read as well. And we all agreed the ones that he liked the most were also the ones that we liked the most. So that was easy. And then we started just translating in our, from the languages that we were, you know, in my case, Chinese, and Michael's case, Tibetan. But then sometimes I've read the Chinese versions of the stories just to see. And some of them are a little bit different, you know, and that's something that Pema Tseten himself mentioned several times to us, that he tends to translate his stories. Maybe he's inspired by a topic and he writes the story in Tibetan, and then he decides to translate it to Chinese, and it may not be necessarily word by word, because he may think that the Chinese readers need more explanation of this or that, that maybe Tibetan readers don't do. So he does kind of an interpretation at the same time that he's translating. So there may be some slight differences in between the stories in one language or the other. Or some stories that he openly said, I think this story is more appropriate for Tibetan readers because it will not say much to Chinese readers, for example. So it's interesting how in his mind he has a clear idea of readership and the language in which a story should come out for the first time. That doesn't mean that maybe in a little while he will not decide to translate it to the other language, you know. But it was a very interesting process to see that.
It really was. In talking to him and literally sitting there with the table of contents of his anthologies, he had a very clear sense of which stories should be translated from Tibetan and which from Chinese. And to some degree, it was because there were, in the Chinese stories, he would explain more to what he felt was a non-Tibetan audience, aspects that a Tibetan audience would just know as part of their background knowledge. And so, for example, A New Golden Corpse, which is a very famous Tibetan oral story. There's more explanation about it in the Chinese version.
Mm-hmm. Yes, like background explanation that the Chinese reader will need, right? And the American reader too, or the English reader. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So for the stories translated from Tibetan, then, how did you sort of handle this? Did you sometimes crib some sections from the Chinese where some of that extra explanation of cultural practices was included? Or did you just try to stay more faithful to that Tibetan text that perhaps lacked that degree of explanation?
I'm a very faithful to the text translator, so I think sometimes to a fault. I think it's true that with the Tibetan stories that they kind of stood on their own. And I'll say with one major exception, which was a single sheet of paper. And, you know, there, as we get into some of the more magical realism stories towards the end of the collection, it can be very difficult to translate when a sentence opens up with a blue sun. You're going, am I translating this correctly? and there, Patty was really able to help me a lot with a very difficult story by reading the Chinese version and us working together on it.
Yeah, that story was puzzling, and I hope that readers like it. But it was kind of puzzling and hard to translate. Yeah,
I can only imagine. To me, I mean, it seemed, yeah, that particular one. We'll come to it in a little bit, but it was quite difficult to unpack. So, moving into this to the book itself, or to the meat of the book itself, you have these stories, and it does seem, as you just sort of suggested, Michael, that you go from more, it works along a spectrum from the more realist to the more magical realist. or the more fantastic, perhaps. And it begins with this story about Orjin, a character named Orjin and his teeth, in which this title character is sort of remembering his life with a childhood friend who then was recognized as a lama. And after he passed, that friend's, the lama's teeth were then collected, or before he passed, when he was recognized, his teeth were collected. And then after he passed, they were put in a reliquary, a chwiten, a stupa, for people to, for circumambulation and other worship. Michael, can you tell us a little bit about this story and sort of maybe what it means to you and how it tells us perhaps about Tibetan belief in contemporary China, maybe?
Yeah, it was one of my favorite stories. I think one aspect of this story in particular, which doesn't come out some in some of his other stories, is his sense of humor. And there's some very subtle, but I think very humorous points in the story. But I think it also, it goes back to that sense of depicting daily life, real life. I think Pema grew up, he said he grew up near a tulku, or a reincarnated lama. And the, you know, there's certainly a strong sense of reverence towards this lama in the story, but also this kind of just a sense of, okay, yes, he's a reborn lama, but we grew up together and I gave him my homework and he copied my homework, and but I couldn't help him on the tests. And it's kind of like, okay, there's this sense of very sincere sense of devotion towards the lamas, to the religion. But here's kind of what it is day to day to live in this context of going to school with somebody like that.
Yeah, and then I think it's interesting, the sense of humor you also see in the ending. It's always that last punch that Pema gives the reader. So I don't know if you want us to you know, talk about the ending, but in any case, is that surprising aspect of it. And then that it seems that at the end you cannot but just laugh, you know. And I've seen that also with the ending, for example, of other stories, like A New Golden Corpse, Tail Gun, or, you know, or Afternoon. This kind of that ending that is close to it, kind of a humoristic ending that I think is so interesting.
Yeah, let's just give our listeners a little forewarning. If you don't want to know the ending, maybe fast forward about 30 seconds from now. But if you do, can you guys sort of tell us what about that sort of humorous ending and the way that comes out?
Michael, that's you.
Yeah, the narrator goes in search of trying to figure out just how many teeth are in a normal human being, as the monks try to collect all these different teeth and end up with way more teeth than a human being should have, and it sparks a memory of him losing a teeth and throwing it up on the roof and having it included. So here at the end, he's thinking one of his teeth is actually in the reliquary, and will be there for all of time, being venerated.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's interesting.
It is. It's a really interesting moment. And a fantastic ending. So after Orjin's teeth, then we have this this story Tarlo, which he has adapted into what has now probably become his most famous, or at least his most award-winning film, having won awards at the Venice Film Festival. This one, you guys, or collectively, you guys chose to translate it from the Chinese. Patty, can you sort of t- tell a little bit about Tarlo in case anybody doesn't know about it, and sort of how it fits in this collection?
Yes, Tarlo is that's the name of the protagonist, who's a shepherd, a herdsman, without family, and he's never been away from his from the mountains. Basically, he's not doesn't know how to socialize very well because he's mostly always with tending the sheep, and he doesn't see a lot of people. So at some point, he has everybody in the village is summoned to have their pictures taken and get an identification card. So he's called and he has to go to the city nearby and get his ID. And it's a new experience for him because he had not been in the county city before. And the whole experience of taking a picture is kind of new to him. And everybody talks about his braid. He has a little braid. And in the process, he meets somebody that, he's not sure about what kind of relationship that person was to have with him. And in the end, leads to possibly, that person stealing his money and things like that. So it's kind of that tension in between the people coming from the countryside to the city, and also the Tibetans in the city being Sinese side, or kind of more accustomed to the Chinese ways of doing things, or the modern city life ways of doing things, and the shock that he has. And then again, it has an ending that is surprising. It's different from the movie. I think the movie takes this to a more dramatic, ending, which the story doesn't have. The story's ending is kind of bitter. It's bitter comic. So it has humor, but still you feel the sadness of the character. But it makes it into a very interesting story. I don't know if Michael wants to add something of his own reading of Tarlo.
No, that's great.
I would also add, one of the things that most interests me about Tarlo as a phenomenon is the way it is so multimedia. I mean, we have the story version now translated into English. There's the film, which is phenomenal, but also shot in black and white, which is interesting in its own way. The hip-hop artist Diji Tsirang made a rap song, also in black and white, with a black and white video in which he's rapping about Tarlo. And the title character Shitinima, or the person who plays the title character Shitinima, in the same year also created a comic sketch in which he and the primary female character in the film sort of do Tarlo Part 2, in which they sort of meet again years later. And we have this whole sort of multimedia phenomenon that extends from this story, which I just think it is fascinating, and also makes the written version itself so worthy of reading and inclusion. So thank you guys.
No problem. One thing that I think both the movie and the story share is that those passages when he's reciting Mao Zedong's speech, and that, I think that's very interesting, because it's yet another way in which Pema Tseten is showing you how Tibetan people were exposed to communism, but somebody like Tarlo never fully understood the meaning of what he was forced to recite and memorize, and it's interesting. And I think the same lack of understanding of the context of that communist passage happens when he goes to the city, because it's a reality that he has never experienced before. So again, there's that misunderstanding of maybe clues that the city people are giving him, and the misunderstanding of that background, that whole background. So it's, and how he has to negotiate these things, So it makes it extremely interesting.
Yeah, it really is a masterwork. Following on from that, we have this story, Men and Dog. Michael, tell us a little bit about this story.
It always, I kind of think of it in terms also of Pema's movie Old Dog, and his, in a sense, taking up this the role of dogs in Tibetan society. It was actually Men and Dog, I think, was one of his stories that almost reads like a film. It, you know, it starts with a setting of people who come together, not through any planning, but they come together every year at this one place in winter. And it speaks, it was a very powerful and in a way somewhat and very disturbing story, but it speaks to, again, he depicts kind of what's happening in over the course of this day and night with each of these families that comes together just on a very personal level, but also very masterfully invokes kind of the, mass, or in this case, from a mass of four families, the kind of group fear or group hysteria that can come over people and cause them to act in a way that is puzzling to themselves. And that's how the story ends, with this, again, one of his dramatic endings that leaves you just unsure of what the people themselves even feel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's interesting also the way in which he's depicting the families during the beginning of that evening being so loving towards themselves. You know, there's a family, the couple that just married, and the daughter that is taking care of her mother who's sick, and the way that they can be so loving and so tender to each other, and then that they can also come to this, you know, mass hysteria that Michael referred to, and commit an act of, you know, savage act. So kind of that duality in the human being, I think, is interesting. I don't know if it's worth, you know, exploring it, but Pema has a fascination with dogs, and I think writing about dogs, or other people who have written about dogs, and he mentioned that he wanted to publish. He's been translating stories of other Tibetan writers who write in Tibetan into Chinese to publish kind of a series on Tibetans and dogs, you know. So, and I think that much can be said about the Tibetan Mastiff as a representation of the Tibetan nationality somehow, right? So it's things that can be researched in this short story, and also in his movie, Old Dog. What is the symbology of that Tibetan Mastiff?
Absolutely. That was going to be my follow-up, actually, sort of about this place of the Mastiff, because I think you're right. I think there's this whole sort of phenomenon around the Mastiff in Tibet that ties in with sort of a broader, now waning craze for Tibetan Mastiffs that saw them become extremely expensive dogs for that people, particularly in the Chinese cities, would purchase. Also saw stories about Tibetan Mastiffs as well. One that comes to mind is the from Han authors, including the popular sort of internet novel Zhang Di Mima, the Tibet Code, which features this whole sort of section the whole story begins around a photograph of an impossibly large mastiff. So I think you're right in pointing out there's this whole sort of thing, both for Pema personally, but in sort of broader ethnic and national sort of imaginaries about Tibet. Moving on to the next story, we have Afternoon, which I thought was just a really interesting and humorous story as well, sort of following this character named Young Wangbum as he prepares to go visit his lover, following the sort of the Tibetan tradition of night visitations, somehow oblivious to the fact that it's actually broad daylight.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a quite interesting story.
And in it, we also have this appearance of this character, Uncle Tumba, who's Uncle Tumba is a sort of a Tibetan folk hero. And I think there seems to be a lot going on in this story. And Patty, I was hoping you could help us sort of unpack some of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the funny thing is that through the course of the day, some people are giving him cues about not being, I mean, he keeps telling people that I see you a certain time or things like that. He himself keeps looking at the sun and thinking that is the moon and understanding, kind of praising people for working so so hard at night when in fact they're working during the day, or thinking that Uncle Tomba is just praying outside his house in the evening when in fact he's doing that during the day and things like that. That makes it very interesting. It's also interesting to see him, his the background of this character. He has he's an orphan, so and apparently several women would like to for him to become their husband, but he's set on Dolma, his girlfriend, and he wants to marry her. But at some point, he's reminded that he really has nothing to his name to be able to marry her. So it's interesting because it also gives a glimpse to what is to marry in traditional Tibetan society, which I think it makes it very interesting. I love the humoristic ending when he realizes that, in fact, it's not the middle of the night, but the middle of the day. And then he just decides, okay, I'll just go back and take a nap and come back at night. So as if nothing had happened. And so I think it's just this quite interesting as a whole story, because you don't know that he's just completely misguided about the time of the day until the end of the story.
One of the things I like about the story so much is, as Patty said, the humor in it. But it also, in a sense, like Men and Dog, it concentrates on a very kind of small inside story of Tibetan culture. Some of the other stories has the following one, Eight Sheep and Ngong. We see the conflicts that arise between traditional culture and we'll say modernizing influences. But this story and the preceding one, Men and Dog, are very just kind of small depictions or snapshots of Tibetan life.
Tim, what was your take on the appearance of Uncle Tomba?
Well, I was just personally a little bit fascinated by it, because you do see it in the work of some other authors where Uncle Tomba is this character who comes in different ways. I'm thinking of the Sinophone Tibetan author Alai, for example, has a short story about Uncle Tomba, but also in his novel about King Gesar, the epic hero of Tibet, he also, in this novel, he includes Gesar meeting Uncle Tomba and thinking about what that would be like. And sort of, so it was interesting to me the way that Bema Tsetan also sort of finds a place for Uncle Tomba in his narrative, and sort of the way that it works in. Michael, you just mentioned Eight Sheep, which I also thought was this really interesting story, because this is the first time we have sort of a foreign character working their way into one of the stories. Prior to this point, it seems like all the stories have been resolutely Tibetan, pretty much, in their content. Now and this story, it has a character named Yalo sitting on the grassland, and a foreigner just sort of walks up to him. And in the process, this foreigner who happens to, I think, be from New York City, finds out about 9/11 happening back home. And in the end walks off, a little shaken. Can you sort of tell us a little bit more about Eight Sheep and its sort of navigation of this, transnational encounter?
It's very interesting, because it starts talking from the perspective of a young shepherd. And then he's lost. He has lost his mom, and he's very sad about it. He has lost, even more recently, sheep that have been killed by wolves. And so he's trying to deal with his grief. And then he finds this foreigner. And then towards the end, the foreigner is trying to deal with the grief of realizing that his city has been attacked. And in the process of them dealing with the grief, they are not able to communicate because the foreigner doesn't speak Tibetan and Yarlo doesn't speak English or even Chinese. The foreigner speaks a little bit of Chinese. And it's interesting how they are able to kind of like each other, and they share food and they gifts, but they always misunderstand what the other is trying to say in a way that ends their own conversation or their own assumptions about the other. So they misunderstand each other, but it's in a very cute and lovely way. But in the end, I think they are able to maybe become friends, even though they are not able to communicate verbally. And comfort each other one way or another through these little gifts that they are giving each other or the food. They understand that there is a sense of loss and desperation in one another, and they try to comfort each other, even though they don't understand exactly what is the loss that each of them has been experiencing. So I think that's what makes the story so interesting.
I think it's so interesting is in what seems like a simple story, Pema's really kind of operating on two very different levels. At one of this conflict or encounter between cultures who literally don't understand each other, but also on a very human level, as Patty said, of grief, of loss, and being able to reach across to each other through that shared experience.
There are also little hints. Pema is not a political writer. He's not interested in making political statements at all. But you can still see little things on how life is influencing or what's going on socially. The political changes are influencing the day-to-day life of the Tibetan nomads, or like fencing, for example. There is a time where the boy constantly saying, "Oh, somebody's approaching," and that person has to jump over fences because now the grasslands are fenced. And at some moment, I think he even mentions how that has caused some issues with like people used to get along better before fencing, but not after fencing. So even though it's not making a political statement, it's also still telling you how these things are affecting the lives of people just by telling you so-and-so has to jump over the fence, and things of that nature. So it makes it into a very, a whole picture of how things are. And also, these foreigners coming, the foreigners maybe idealizing Tibet the same way that these men, the traveler idealized Tibetans and Tibet, and the reality that in the end, the foreigner doesn't really understand life in Tibet, and Tibetans don't really understand him either. So that makes it interesting.
I think you're right. I think it's one of the masterpieces, and I'm really glad you brought that up, sort of the masterpieces, master strokes of his narrations, where it's sort of just in narrating real life, these various changes to real life sort of make their way in different ways. With Tarlo, it's the need for identification that is issued by the state, and then the fencing in of the grasslands in a sheep. In every way, these sort of, you can't be realistic without those, which is really fantastic. The following story was really, we start to get sort of away from the very realistic of the stories and start moving towards the more fantastic. This is the story from which the volume takes its title, Enticement. And in this story, we have this character named Jayant Denzin, who has this karmic connection that with a book that just draws him to it in almost disturbing ways. Patty, you translated this from the Chinese. Tell us a little bit about this, about enticement.
Mm-hmm. The story is fascinating because when you think you understand the main character, it just takes a turn, and then you see another side of the main character that you didn't saw it existed. And then when you think that, oh, now I understand what's going on, then it makes another turn. And I think that's what makes it enticing and fascinating. So, and also the more magical realist aspects that are present in this story. So the story starts with this young boy being mesmerized by the apecha, or you know, the sutras that an old man has in the village, and he befriends the daughter of the man just to be able to approach that sutra, and then he's never able to get close to it. The man obviously doesn't understand that karmic connection that you mentioned of the boy with the scriptures, and he misunderstands him. He thinks he just will not pay its due respect to them. So it always locks the pechas in boxes and this and that. And there's a series of different things that happen, and he ends up marrying the girl just to have access to it after the father dies. So that's when you start seeing, kind of the non-holy image of him and other things that happen in the story that I don't want to really ruin the experience of the reader. But it gets to a point where you start thinking that he's just crazy, So you, at the beginning, you understand the connection with the scriptures that he might have, but then all of a sudden you think that he's just gone mad. And then towards the end of the story, you understand that he was just karmic linked to that pecha especially. And his fight, the constant fight to be able to open it until his death, So it's just, I think I would say it's maybe my favorite story by Pema Tseten. I don't know if Michael wants to add more to that.
Yeah, I just add it. It's similar to the first story, Bergen's Teeth, that it's part of Pema's uniqueness that he can depict the devotion, the karmic links, the idea of karmic links to books, very sincerely, but also it show the kind of just what it's like to actually grow up and be in the Tibetan culture that's so influenced by religion. I think there's a tendency in the West to sort of idealize the Tibetan religion, and Pema kind of brings us down to earth, but not in a sarcastic or even critical way, but one that balances both kind of, okay, this is what it's really like, with a sincere devotion.
Yeah, there's, I'm just thinking about this old man that was kind of the owner of that set of scriptures that he was, so mesmerized by, and how at some point that old man becomes a monk that has to take care of our protagonist, right? So, and he's a monk, but he's not necessarily a monk you can identify with. So is that what Michael was saying, that other side of religion, right? There's also some moments in that they are very comical in a story that they has also some tragic moments. But I'm still, for example, remember how the woman at the store is killed, and she still grabs one of her shoes in her hand. So that makes it a very tragicomical, instance. Or at the end of the story, when one of the young lamas is just kind of he knows that he shouldn't be looking at something, but he just peeks because he cannot help it and things like that. And there are also moments of true beauty in the way that Pema Tseten masters the language. I remember, for example, struggling of how to convey the beauty of a description when he explains that the protagonist is so attracted by the scriptures, that he sees a myriad of color katas coming from the scriptures and kind of grabbing him. So it was so hard for me to come up with a beautiful way to portray that the enticement that he felt by the scriptures and how he really felt physically moved to them through that kind of it's just so hard to explain. People have to read it. But I think that in terms of the mastery of the language, this is a story that where Pema has proved that he's a true master in writing.
Absolutely. It's a really excellent story that really resists the sort of simple descriptions I'm asking you to give here, and people definitely do need to read it. The next story in the volume, I think in my first reading, this was probably my favorite, just as a folklorist by training myself. This one entitled "A New Golden Corpse Gun." And this story I really did enjoy. It sort of builds off of the Murotse Drong, the stories of the Golden Corpse, and it's this sort of frame story in which a boy has to go and take a golden corpse to his master, and he's not allowed to talk to the corpse. And if he does, it will return to the charnel grounds where it stays most of the time. And while they walk together, or while the boy is carrying the golden corpse tries to tell him stories to get him to talk, to get him to say a word. And in this, Bema Tsitin is reimagining or working within this larger tradition or appropriating this larger tradition to tell the story about multiple generations in one family and the place of guns and local religious beliefs and all these and gambling and all these other sort of social things going around in this depiction. It really is a fascinating story. Patty, how does Gun sort of fit in and sort of help us better understand Bema Tsitin's corpus and this particular volume in particular?
I think that he's, he told me so. He was always fascinated by the Golden Corpse Tale. And in fact, it was one of his first translations. I think that when he thought that because we haven't talked about it, but Pema is a wonderful filmmaker and a wonderful writer, but he's an avid translator himself. And that's part of his studies, but also something that he really enjoys doing. So he wants to translate a lot of things written in Tibetan to Chinese to share it with those who cannot read Tibetan. And actually, this was one of the first stories that he translated when he was very young. And I think that he just wanted to give a new spin on it. So he took this old tale and just changed the story a little bit or added new things, like the presence of this gun and new characters. And we tried to convey that because it was kind of hard to tell the readers which part of the story was the original part that he was just, reusing, and which part of the story was his own new adding. So we did it by changing the font somehow, so people will understand. And I think one of the factors that is very important is that it retains that comical aspect of the golden corpse always trying to trick the carrier of the golden corpse, and as always, the end of it. The end of the story is what gives you that last sense of Pema Tsitin's humor and the impossible of different situations. As you mentioned, there are different layers of meanings in the story because it's also a very interesting social critique towards gambling and the loss of traditional Tibetan beliefs like we saw in Tarlo and other stories. So there's a lot to read in that story itself.
I think Patty had the idea of using both fonts to depict to separate and identify the traditional aspects of the story and then how Pema has updated. And I think it was just a stroke of genius on Patty's part to do that, because you really see the roots in the tradition, and then how Pema has taken this story, a very traditional story of a trickster, and updated it to something that someone today can read and enjoy and ponder over without it, and making it more accessible to people now.
Absolutely. It was, I mean, it really, really sort of draws you in. The final three stories in this collection are a little bit harder to describe, so I'm not going to give much introduction to them. But Michael, maybe you can tell us, since all of them were translated from the Tibetan, Michael, maybe you can tell us a little bit about these three. So a single sheet of paper first, you sort of mentioned a little bit earlier. It seemed really sort of impenetrable. Tell us a little bit about this story.
Well, it is, I agree, it is impenetrable in some ways. And we wondered whether to include it or not, even amongst the translators involved in our group. But it was a story that Pema picked out specifically and really wanted to include. And like I noted earlier, it came with a fair amount of translation difficulties because it's such a fantastic, it's like a dreamlike or a fantasy, you could say magical realism, but it's kind of a dream or a fantasy that you're kind of wondering what's actually going on here, what's happening. The next story, Gong, again, goes into this kind of fantastical world of two people who you can see through their bodies and how they become an object of display. And here again, one can see the conflict between traditional culture and modernizing influences. And Pema depicts so wonderfully the influences of news organizations scrambling to get a story, or the effects of tourism down to, you know, discarded cigarette butts and fruit peels lying on the street. And then they kind of just the greed that can emerge in a small community. But it was actually the first story I translated and still one of my favorite, because there's just a beautiful poignancy that comes through the story, and particularly at the end. A poignancy, I think, for kind of older traditional Tibetan culture that's very much rooted in the land and specifically in the mountains.
Yes, and that I think that one thing that I wanted to say about A Single Sheet of Paper is that it reflects that. If you can take out something of that, such a complex story, is I think the fear of maybe what's going to happen in the millennia, you know, when we get to the new millennia or something like that. I don't know, maybe that is kind of one of the stories coming up of that sense of insecurity or not knowing what the future will bring us. So that's something that could be taken out of it. For Gang, there's so many, also again, layers of meanings. If you want to think about why he's choosing for these two characters that clearly represent Tibet, you know, and Tibetan identity, to be transparent and for people to want to take advantage of them. A lot of things that can be read into that. And I think it's not a coincidence that he chose to write it in Tibetan to begin with. These are really stories. These last three stories leave you a lot to think about, also with Doctor, that is a story of villages are losing a sense of, you know, they are just forgetting about their identity completely. And they spend the whole story waiting for the doctor to come and save them. And in the end, that doesn't happen. But it's quite interesting that also this story, Doctor, that has makes you think so much about the continuity of Tibetan identity and how people, kind of fight for to preserve Tibetan identity when so many changes are being introduced due to globalization and things like that, and how I think these Pema's writing these stories is in these styles that are kind of surrealistic or magical realistic is a way for him to let us think about those topics, because it's really hard to, I mean, he has delved into these topics in a more realistic way, like we saw in Tarlo, but he does it in a different way, in a surrealistic or kind of surreal way for us to think even more about those issues.
You know, as Patty said, him is not an overtly political writer, but these last three stories, they're kind of three different takes or three different facets of looking at identity and looking at changing identity at this time of political and social change.
And so he doesn't make a statement. He just brings something up for you to think about it. And that's why I think makes Pema such a wonderful writer.
Absolutely. I agree on all points. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, both of you, and I want to thank you so much for being so generous with it. Before I let you go, though, I was wondering if you guys could talk about what you guys are working on now or what's coming next.
I've been working, I've been doing research and taking my students to Tibetan areas to do research on environmental problems in Tibet and how those environmental problems are related to solutions that Tibetans are looking for right now, and how that also links to the preservation of Tibetan identity and religion. So those are the things I'm looking into recently.
Two of my great loves are history and literature. So I've actually been going back and renewing some research on a fascinating 17th century Tibetan Lama, Katok Sewong Norbu, who was a historian himself and was a mediator among many of the conflicts at that time, as well as Pema's certainly whetted my appetite for contemporary Tibetan literature, which is just exploding. And there's just so many talented writers writing now whose works aren't accessible. So it's my hope to try to make a little bit more of this great talent and creativity more accessible.
Oh, both projects sound so amazing. I can't wait to see what you both start coming out with in the near future. Well, Patty, Michael, thank you so much for being on the show and for telling us a little bit about your new book.
Thank you so much.